watches. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, or WXXC Truxton. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. The international human rights NGO Amnesty International defines a person as a political prisoner if their imprisonment has a political background. This may include being a member of a forbidden political party, or being involved in armed struggle against the government, or being victims of other kinds of systematic discrimination based on sex, race, or other reasons. Many people think that there are no political prisoners in the United States. In fact, there is a long history of use of the judicial system as a weapon against political dissenters. And dissenters who cross the line into various kinds of militant action consistently receive harsher sentences than persons committing the same actions for non-political reasons. Tonight we'll hear from two women, Linda Evans and Susan Rosenberg, who each spent 16 years in prison for their politically motivated acts. Basically, the definition of what is and isn't crime is wholly political, as action becomes criminalized through an arbitrary process of legislation, a process conducted by less than perfect individuals which is often riddled with corruption and influence peddling. This is then dignified as the law and spoken about in reverent tones. Thus, a person who buys and drinks beer is not a criminal, and a person who buys and smokes marijuana is. A woman who has sex with a man after being given a dinner and a bouquet of flowers is not a criminal. A woman who has sex with a man after being given the cash equivalent of dinner and flowers is a criminal. Some actions have been crimes at various times, like drinking beer, organizing a labor union, loving someone of your same sex, or refusing to participate in a war. Now, as a result of intellectual property laws pushed through Congress by entertainment conglomerates, writing a computer program can also be a crime. We'll hear about the case of a computer programmer arrested by the FBI after making a presentation at a conference. And we'll hear new evidence in the case of a man who may be America's most famous political prisoner, Mumia Abu-Jamal.
My guns talk the best, but the rangers and deputies are hired by the rich man to catch me and hang me, my shiny black bears.
As Professor Noam Chomsky said on our program 2 weeks ago, creating a fear of crime is a method of social control that causes the electorate to accept more invasive and stringent laws and an increasing amount of surveillance in return for supposed protection. The mass media, especially television, is cranking out a host of programs about law enforcement agencies designed to make the viewer identify with the enforcers. The voices and concerns of the alleged criminals are never heard, and the ultimate conclusion which is to be drawn is that the 2 million Americans now languishing in jail must be bad people who belong there. Next, two women who were until recently among that 2 million. The interviewer is Bear from KMOD Radio in Redway, California.
I interviewed Linda Evans on May 14th in Oakland, California. Linda was released from federal prison January 20th, 2000, one of over 400 prisoners who received clemency from President Clinton. Linda, you served over 16 years in prison. What were you convicted of?
I was a political prisoner, and what I used to explain to people inside is that that means that we were trying to change the government. The actual charges that I was convicted of were harboring a fugitive, my comrade Marilyn Buck, with whom I was arrested, having a firearm on me when I was arrested, making false statements to buy four otherwise legal guns, for which I got a sentence of 30 years. Most people get probation or under 2 years for that sentence, so mine was probably the longest in history. And I was also convicted as part of the resistance conspiracy case in Washington, D.C., which was a conspiracy to, according to the government, influence, protest, and change U.S. policies and practices in international and domestic affairs by violent and illegal means. So we were trying to change the government.
Yeah.
Well, the resistance conspiracy case actually included a series of 8 armed attacks on various government and military institutions, including the War College in Washington, D.C., which is on an Army base, 2 actions at the Navy Yard, which were basically against U.S. intervention in Central America and to support the demand for Puerto Rican independence and to stop the bombing of Vieques, which was going on then just as it is going on now. Also, there was an action against the South African consulate to protest U.S. involvement in apartheid. There was an action against Israeli aircraft industries to protest U.S. involvement with Israel against the Palestinian people. And there was an action at the Police Benevolent Association of New York after a series of police killings of third world people, especially young people of color, including Michael Stewart, who was a graffiti artist, and Eleanor Bumpers, who was a grandmother who was killed while she was evicted from her apartment.
And these bombings, were any people injured in them, or is it strictly material damage?
There was a tremendous effort made so that people would not be hurt in any way, and nobody was ever hurt in any of these actions, including the U.S. Capitol bombing, which was to protest the invasion of Grenada and the bombing of Lebanon by U.S. warships in 1983. There were warning calls called in, and the purpose of the actions was really to draw attention to U.S. policies rather than to commit a lot of property destruction. It basically was property destruction, and on a relatively limited extent.
Let's back up a little. Let's talk a little bit about your upbringing. I know you were active in the Girl Scouts. Yeah. And what effect, if any, do you think scouting had on your later development as a revolutionary?
I was brought up in Iowa. I really always have considered myself to be a very ordinary person. And my parents were Republicans. And yes, I was in the Girl Scouts. I was also in debate club and basically had a very protected childhood. I think that the values with which I was raised in my family, which perhaps included some of the most basic values of scouting, were compassion, were service to the community, giving back to the community, and a basic love for people. And those values certainly influenced my development as a revolutionary. And I feel strongly that I have tried to put those values into practice in my life.
Susan Rosenberg said that at the time leading up to her arrest in the early 80s, she and her comrades felt that people in the progressive movements were backing off from commitment to strong political action. And in another interview, Father Daniel Berrigan echoed this thought. Is that how it seemed to you? And what compelled you to take such strong action?
Well, Susan and I were working together. So our goals were the same as far as trying to inspire people to be more creative, to be more militant, to be more committed to the struggle for justice and to solidarity with struggles that were going on all over the world, particularly national liberation struggles and the fight of oppressed people in this country for justice. So we hoped that the actions that we took would be that inspiration and would show people that the U.S. government is not invincible and that we can develop a revolutionary movement that will be able eventually to win change.
And what motivated you to commit yourself to the struggle against racism and imperialism?
Part of it, I think, is empathy and really looking at the world around me and deciding that I wanted to take a stand with the people of the world, that I did not want to be exceptionalized. I didn't want to be living a better life than anybody else in the world, and recognizing that if we really have values of equality, then that means that we have to change our lives too, and I'm willing to accept those changes. When I was in college was when I first took a step and understood a little bit about racism, because I had grown up in a very small town in Iowa. There were hardly any Black, maybe a few Native American, no Chicano people at all in this town, and I had never been to a big city. So I went to college at Michigan State University, and as part of one of our field trips, we went to Detroit, and we walked around the Black community, and for the first time in my life, I was walking on broken glass, looking at the projects, and seeing the conditions that people had to live in the community, and I couldn't accept it. I couldn't accept the gap between the academic ivory tower that I was involved in school, and the conditions of real life that Black people had to face. So I went back to the campus, and there was a struggle at that point for Black studies, for more Black professors, and for open admissions, which is basically a guarantee that anybody that graduates from high school in the state of Michigan or other states would be assured of entrance into one of the state universities. That has been wiped out, as we know, along with affirmative action. But at that time, in 1967, it was a very strong demand of the Black Student Union, and they sat in at the administration building, and I sat in with them. It was a big step for me. It was a risk, and I was worried about getting arrested or getting hit by the police in the head or getting suspended from school, all those terrible things that could happen. But I took the step anyway because I felt that those demands were correct. And I think for the very first time, I realized that for me as a white woman to fight for a Black Studies department was not only to support the Black students in their demand, but would eventually benefit me as well, because I would have access to learning Black history, to studying with Black professors who would have a different perspective, and that I would receive an infinitely better education myself. So I began to understand how solidarity is really a two-way street, and that everybody involved in those kinds of struggles does benefit, and that it's time that we stop defining our self-interest in a narrow way and really recognize that when we join in struggles for justice, no matter who is leading them, that everybody is going to benefit.
You've been incarcerated in several different state and federal prisons. Could you talk about the differences and also about the women you were locked up with?
It's actually been very hard for me to leave the people that I was locked up with. I have a lot of very strong memories and strong emotional ties to the women that I was with, many of whom are lifers. One of the things about the federal sentencing system is that the mandatory sentences are resulting in people being locked down for very, very long periods of time. And in the federal system, a tremendously large number of people are from other countries. I would estimate that at FCI Dublin, the Federal Correctional Institute at Dublin, which is where I was in prison most of the time that I was locked up, about 40% of the women are from other countries all over the world. A lot of Latin American women, Central American women, Mexicans, people from Africa, from Thailand, basically all over the globe, because the U.S. is acting as the policeman of the world. And if they arrest somebody that, say, is here as an undocumented worker, even if the crime of which they're accused isn't a crime in their own country, they are forced to serve their sentence here and then be deported back to their own nation. So you have a lot of people, the women, of course, that I was with, who are separated from their culture, from their families, by many thousands of miles. And they might be locked up for 10 years without ever seeing a family member, and often without even being able to call them, because the long-distance calling internationally is extremely expensive. And, of course, in prison, the basic wage is $5.25 a month. Consequently, you can't exactly do a lot of telephone calling, since we pay for our phone calls.
$5.25 a month?
A month. That's for pretty full-time work and in various departments. There are prison industries where people can make up to 80 or 90 cents an hour. It takes a long time for women to advance through the wage system in the prison industries to be able to make 80 or 90 cents an hour. And the number of people that are at the top of the wage pyramid is very small. So most women, even if they work in prison industries, make about 30 or 40 cents an hour. And that doesn't add up very quickly. Also, women from other countries are systematically denied access to those jobs due to a racist ruling, I believe, by the U.S. federal court system, where some white prisoner somewhere sued the prison industries, Unicor, saying that because people are here illegally, they should not be allowed to work in federal prison industries. Now, that means that people are locked up in this country but don't have access to even the same minimum jobs that are available to other prisoners. So it's a tremendous hardship for the women, because most of them are extremely poor. They came here for economic reasons in the first place, and they have no support from their families. So they go through their many years in prison unable to buy things on commissary, unable to call their families, and basically really suffering.
And what would you say is the average age of women that you're locked up with? Are they fairly young?
It's very diverse in terms of age, actually. I would say probably in their 20s, late 20s is the average age. I think that the women from the United States, the black women and the Latina women and the white women, tend to be younger, perhaps, than some of the women from other countries. I think the other thing I would like to just say about the women inside and conditions inside is that there really are no educational opportunities at all. As of 1995, the Pell Grants, which were, perhaps some of your listeners might be familiar with them, are available to people inside the United States to augment their scholarships, etc., that they have to go to college. Pell Grants were taken away from prisoners in 1995. And when they were at FCI Dublin, over 200 women were enrolled in the college program. So when the Pell Grants were cut, it meant that none of those women were able to continue with any kind of college education. So something that had a program that had been very rehabilitative and very important to women's self-esteem and their continuing mental growth was suddenly unavailable. What exists now is a GED program and nothing more. There's absolutely no education past a GED level. And it's a big problem in terms of people coming out into the world and really even being unable to run a computer.
We're speaking with Linda Evans. She was a political prisoner for 16 years.
Could you give us an idea of a typical day in your life as a federal prisoner?
So you get up in the morning, 6 o'clock, 6:30. There are three people in a room, in a cell, about 7 by 10 feet. So there isn't very much room to move around. I would say probably about 10 inches between the beds, and that's it. That's all the room you have. So you take turns getting up. You have to work out with your roommate. If you're women, who needs the most time in the mirror to fix their hair and put on makeup and stuff like that. So you work it out if you are on speaking terms with your roommates, which is often difficult in such a tiny space. Take turns getting up. People go to eat breakfast at the dining hall and then go to work. And you work pretty much from 7:30 till whenever you take a lunch break. You get half an hour or 45 minutes for lunch, go back to work, and then at 4 o'clock, there is an institutional count. And everybody is done working by that time. We get locked in our cells, and you have to stand up as the cop passes the door and looks in the window and counts you. Sometimes that takes a long time because they can't count. After the 4 o'clock count, they unlock the doors, there's mail call, people go to dinner, and then the evening is relatively free time. There are programs. People do recreational activities like aerobics or lifting weights or walking the track. There are sometimes programs, and then you're locked in again at 9 o'clock. People are locked into the unit about 9. At 9:30, there was another count. After the count, you're again, the doors are opened up again, and you can be out in the lobby of the living unit till midnight. During the day, there is a closed movement policy, which means that if you're going to classes or coming back from work, you have a 10-minute movement between places. So if you're out on the yard, you only have 10 minutes to get from one place to another. That policy of closed movement has not yet been instituted after 4 o'clock. That was a big struggle that we had because they tried to institute it after the prison rebellion in the federal system in 94, I believe it was, when there was a nationwide lockdown of the federal prisons because of the refusal of Congress to change the crack cocaine sentencing laws.
And what does that mean, a lockdown?
We were literally locked in our rooms, in the cells, and they fed us in the living unit, which meant that the staff had to serve us. Everybody kind of laughed at that. But it was very difficult to be locked in for, I think at FCI Dublin, we were locked in for 4 days. Gradually, as things calmed down in the federal system, they let us out, and then they tried to institute more repressive rules. At FCI Dublin, people responded to this by setting fires. And one night at midnight, suddenly fires broke out in the garbage cans in all three of the living units, and people were evacuated onto the yard, and it could have been quite a serious situation, but what actually ended up happening is that they lifted the lockdown because it was a protest of being locked in our cells, and they unlocked the cells.
So it actually was a victory in some sense, but for the prisoners, but it also sounds like it was such a pain for
it was,
the guards that they were ready to give in.
Exactly. Yeah. It was definitely a victory for us, but a lot of people suffered. 60 people got transferred as a result of that very limited rebellion.
And what kind of work did you do when you were in prison?
I did many things. I tried to vary my schedule and my work schedule in particular, depending on who was the boss, who I could really work with as a supervising cop, and tried not to get too terribly bored. It's quite boring and monotonous in prison, and that's a big problem. I worked as a carpenter for a period of time. I worked as a landscape gardener for a long time until they stopped giving us any seeds or any plants to work with. That made it pretty difficult to make it beautiful. And I worked as a garbage collector.
I've seen spectacular displays of quilts you made while in prison. Could you talk about how you got into quilting and the importance of quilting to you?
Years ago, there was a much more extensive kind of vocational training program that existed at FCI Dublin. And we were allowed to take tailoring classes. I was not there at that point in time, but they had acquired some sewing machines, and eventually a quilting teacher came in and did some classes, and I took one of the classes and had some access to the sewing machines. And at that time, we could have material sent in boxes with our clothing. We were allowed to wear our own clothing for up until about 1992. So I got some material and made my comrade Laura Whitehorn a quilt, and it got me hooked. I believe that I worked so much with quilting because of the colors and the textures. As they took away more and more of our personal property, they also stopped us from having any color in our lives. We were all forced to wear khaki. The only kind of leisure clothing or recreational clothing we had was gray sweatsuits or kind of a teal-green sweatsuit, which you make, you got kind of sick of only two colors. And the idea of being able to work with color and texture made my life very much richer. The other part of it for me was that I was able to give gifts to all the people from the outside that were supporting me. And certainly it wasn't an equal exchange, but it made me feel better to be able to show the love and appreciation that I felt for all the years of support from people like you, Bear, who visited me very regularly all that time.
Well, that kind of segues right into the next question about how important was outside support to you as a political prisoner, and how much of it did you receive? How many quilts did you end up making?
I think I might have made and given away about 100 quilts. Words almost fail me about how important the support was, because I felt very privileged to be in the Bay Area, where there was a large community of political activists who had a consciousness about the existence of political prisoners and recognized that it was important to support us and to visit us. I had an extensive correspondence. I wasn't always that great about answering letters, but a lot of people wrote to me, and I did have dialogue with people through the mail and somewhat on the telephone. We really recognized that community support had been so important to us as political prisoners that we wanted to try to find ways to bring the community more in contact with the other women in the prison, as well as provide a service for the women. So in 1991, when I went to FCI Dublin, I went around to various of the other prisoner organizations. There was a Four Winds group for the Native American women, a Black Culture Workshop, and a Latina Club. And I talked to the membership of each of the groups, and different people from those groups volunteered to join with me and start an AIDS education program. We named it PLACE, Pleasanton AIDS Counseling and Education, because at that time, the institution was called FCI Pleasanton. The name was later changed to FCI Dublin. PLACE grew through the years into being a very effective AIDS education and support organization for the women inside. We had speakers from the outside. We interfaced with the community constantly. There were outside sponsors that came to us and helped us with video showings and panels. And eventually we started to do a Prisoners Fight AIDS walkathon, which we did actually for 4 years. In the walkathon, we had sponsors from the outside, and women inside walked and walked and ran and walked thousands of miles. And we actually raised thousands of dollars that we donated in turn to community service organizations that provided services to people with HIV and AIDS on the outside. So we actually gave large amounts of money to the Ambassador Hotel, which was a hotel in the Tenderloin District in San Francisco, where people with AIDS lived in single-room occupancy rooms and had AIDS services in the hotel. These were people, you know, junkies and drag queens and people who had been abandoned by their families because they had AIDS. So our relationship with them was really important to us. We made gifts. We made keychains for them. We made a beautiful village that they had in their lobby at Christmas time of little cardboard houses. And we gave them, you know, large amounts of money for the service organizations that were in the hotel. We also gave money to Camp Sunrise, which is a camp for children with HIV, to the HIV in Prison Project, and to a hospice in Oakland that for women and men who had HIV. Basically, we built relationships with the community outside that helped destigmatize what prisoners are all about. And it also really empowered the women inside because we felt that even though we were at the bottom of society's ladder, we were able to give something to the community. And women spent hours and hours and hours making stuffed animals and sewing toys for children who had AIDS at the Children's Hospital in Oakland and San Francisco. So it was an extremely valuable program and also really provided support for the women inside who had HIV and for women who had family members who had AIDS or HIV. We did orientations for new prisoners talking about tuberculosis, hepatitis C, and HIV, and generally really provided a service that spanned all of the ethnic groups, all of the cultural groups inside, which was a very unifying force and very important because there was a lot of racial tension in the prison. Needless to say, the program was so successful that in 1997 it was outlawed by the prison administration.
Linda Evans, you served over 16 years in prison. How has your political outlook developed?
While I was in prison, I really tried to stay current with what was going on the outside. And I was able to undertake a course of study on globalization and try to understand how U.S. imperialism had developed from the time of the Vietnam War and U.S. interventions in Central America and Africa to today, where we see corporate capitalism trying to take over the world with the assistance of the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. So I would say that that was very important in terms of developing my analysis of how the world works and trying to continue to study and understand how we can build a struggle that will change that system. For example, I think it's extremely important to recognize that the same companies that are logging the forests in Guerrero in Mexico are logging the Northwest and the northern part of California. We have a common struggle with the peasants in Guerrero that are trying to save their land and their forests and their way of life. And I think that people in the United States are have a really important interest in saving the forest lands, the ancient redwoods, the old growth forests here. So if we can recognize that the struggles have a common link and therefore be strategic in targeting the corporations that are logging both in California and in Mexico, I think we will be much more effective than if we look at our struggle as being something separate and unique. So that understanding is something that I have really tried to continue to develop in my own life. I think also I've recognized that the fights for justice that we were participating in before we went into prison, that were part of the motivation for us becoming revolutionaries, is the same now as it was then. the struggle against police brutality, for example, the reason that we bombed the Police Benevolent Association in New York was because of the number of people, youth of color in particular, who had been killed by the New York Police Department. And I come out of prison, and what do we see in Cincinnati but an uprising by the community because of the number of people that had been killed by the Cincinnati Police Department. I think that what this illustrates to me is that we have to keep fighting, and that the struggle is becoming stronger and stronger, but we cannot give up because they are never going to give up. And if we want to really win the opportunity to develop a better world, to create a system or a way of life where people are treated equally, where there is justice, where we actually defeat racism and win women's liberation and gay liberation, we're going to have to develop a community that can sustain itself in struggle. And I think that's very, very important, because otherwise it's really too easy for us to give in to the consumerism and materialism that we're pushed toward every day in our society. And I think that most of us have values that are contrary to that. And we don't like to see Starbucks on every corner. And we don't like to be a part of buying clothing that's made in sweatshops. But we have to struggle so that we have the opportunity to build something different.
When you were incarcerated at FCI Dublin, KPFA was your community radio station. Did you listen to it? Was it important to you?
We listened to it every day. I think that the community radio system is crucial. One of the things I feel strongly in talking to younger activists is that years ago, we had an incredible underground media system. We had underground newspapers in almost every community. We had community radio stations. We had Newsreel, which was making movies and distributing them all over the whole United States and really all over the world. We were active in cable television. And today, coming out, I'm really struck by the fact that we don't know what's going on around the world because the media is so monopolized by just a couple corporations. We don't have access to it. Even the alleged underground or alternative newspapers in our communities aren't responsive to those, to the struggles of activists and even community struggles about gentrification or police brutality are not covered enough in those alternative newspapers. So I think it's crucial that we maintain the community radio stations that do exist, that people participate as volunteers, and that those radio stations be responsive to the community so that we can have access to the news and so we can have access to the airwaves and talk to each other. I think that the internet is a very important tool that did not exist when I went into prison, but it is very limited because not everybody has a computer, whereas most people have a radio. So yeah, KPFA was really, really important, and we supported the struggle as best we could when the staff was locked out. We wrote a solidarity statement and encouraged our visitors to participate in the demonstrations, and it's a big struggle against Pacifica. I'm really hoping that we win.
What has most surprised you since you've been out? Has anything been especially difficult or especially good?
I really have been surprised that I'm not just ecstatic to be free. I thought when I was inside that when I came out, I would just be happy all the time, which I am. I'm very glad to be free, of course, but it has been a very, very mixed experience for me because I left behind my comrade Marilyn Buck, who I did a lot of time with and who is there in FCI Dublin still and has an 80-year sentence, so it's going to be a big struggle to get her released. I left behind almost 100 other political prisoners who are just like myself and who are very dedicated to their communities and yet have done maybe 3 decades locked up in prison. It's a tremendous loss for our community as a whole, for the community of activists as a whole, that people who were active in the Black Panther Party and the Black Liberation Army and in the Puerto Rican Independence Movement, the Native American Sovereignty Movement, are still locked up. It's a tragedy and a crime. And I really feel that it's crucial for people to build a movement that can support these comrades and work to get them free. So I have been very sad leaving behind my comrades and also leaving behind a lot of the women with whom I was very close friends who are still locked up. So that is a very difficult thing for me. The other part that has been difficult has been coming out and really witnessing how much our society has deteriorated. Because 16 years ago, the level of homelessness, the level of poverty and suffering was less than it is today. I have driven through the streets of Los Angeles, where I'm staying right now, and seen blocks and blocks and blocks of people dragging cardboard boxes into place, lining up on the sidewalk, and living in those boxes. They have to move them every day because the police sweep through the area and take the boxes. But at night, there are just rows and rows of people on the street. That's unacceptable. I don't think any of us should accept that as part of what this society dishes out. So I'm angry a lot. I'm very sad a lot of the time, at the same time that I'm really joyful at being free. I was able to walk through Redwood Forest for the first time. I walked on the beach. I went swimming. There are a lot of wonderful experiences that people inside prison are denied. I still almost cry when I look at long distances, like if you look from the top of a hill over a vista of the forest or of the beach or even of a city, because inside you never get to look long distances. And it makes me very sad because some of the most basic experiences in life are being denied to people for years and years and years. And it affects you psychologically, it affects you physically, it affects your vision. Prisons are crime. I really think it's a crime that 2 million people are locked up in prisons in our society. The vast majority of them do not belong there. Since getting out, I have been doing quite a lot of public speaking about the political prisoners, about some of the things that we've been discussing today, about women in prison. And I have truly enjoyed it and also benefited from it because I'm getting a better sense through these dialogues of what is going on in the struggles for justice that are happening today and the movement that's being built today. So that has been really beneficial to me, and I hope to continue doing that. I definitely am going to continue being an activist and trying to participate in community struggles and building the kind of unity that I feel we need to build. I see that we really are pretty fragmented as a left political movement, and I think that's a big problem because it reflects our lack of a vision that is broader, that includes not just single issues that we're trying to reform, but really a vision that is about what kind of society we ultimately want to live in ourselves and want our children to live in. So I feel that we have to talk about that vision and make it very concrete for ourselves so we know what we're fighting for, and that then we'll have the sustenance that we need to keep on struggling through the hard times. By working together, by linking the struggle against gentrification to the struggle against logging, for example, I think that we can build our strength and also fight the racism and white supremacy that keeps those movements separate from each other.
Linda Evans, is there anything else you'd like to share with the listeners?
One of the places that I think political prisoners generally and certainly myself received a lot of support from was from the lesbian and gay community. part of this was because all the political prisoners have been very actively involved in the fight for AIDS education for prisoners and for treatment for people with AIDS in prison. But I think also it comes from the fact that oppressed people identify with the political prisoners, and gay and lesbian people in our society are oppressed. I'm a lesbian. I've been oppressed as a woman. I've been oppressed as a lesbian. And I know that those experiences are part of why I became a revolutionary in the first place, trying to fight for liberation and identifying the fact that for me to be free, I really believe that all people must be free. And I'm committed to fighting until that actually can happen in reality, where people aren't just gunned down in the street by the police, where they're not evicted from their homes by rich white .com elites, and where women have the right to love other women. So I feel that being a lesbian has been very important in my political development as well as in my personal life. And I think that that certainly was true inside prison, where I saw lesbians discriminated against, harassed by the guards, and where human affection is illegal. I learned a lot from the other lesbians that I was with, and I feel that the support of the lesbian and gay community in San Francisco in particular, through Out of Control, which was an organization to free women political prisoners, was critical in me staying strong and sane while I was locked up.
How were lesbians treated by the other women inmates in the prison who were not gay?
There was a lot of discrimination against lesbians, a lot of harassment, actually, from a lot of the women. And at the same time, of course, there were a lot of lesbian relationships. So it was a very mixed kind of situation. The social norm that says it's wrong to be a lesbian, to love other women, is very strong in some cultures. So I think that a lot of the Latin American women who were lesbians had a lot of pressure put on them by other women, Latin American women from their communities. There also was a lot of discrimination against lesbians by the guards, and that was particularly true in the visiting room, so that women who wanted to kiss their lover at the beginning and at the end of our visits, which is the only time physical contact was allowed, were harassed by the guards and at times by the other women in the visiting room. So there were all kinds of levels of difficulties that lesbian relationships faced, both in prison and where partners were separated by prison.
Linda, do you have any final thoughts before we end this interview?
I really want to urge the community to get involved in the prison struggle, both to stop the construction of more prisons, which is a complete waste of money and funnels money that should be put into social programs, whether it be healthcare or education, into prisons, which is warehousing of human beings that should not be locked up. I think that community programs are really important. The prison system is trying to keep the community out of the prisons and to isolate us from our communities, to cut us off, to make all of you forget that 2 million people are locked up in prison, some of them your family members or people that you know, and to individualize us so that the community as a whole isn't involved and it becomes just the responsibility of a family member as an individual to take care of their friend or family member that is in prison. This is a serious problem, and we cannot allow the prison system to cut us off from the community and to cut the community off from the prisoners. So I urge people to develop programs to go into the prison as volunteers, as visitors, to take concerts into the prisons. It takes a lot of dedication and commitment to break through the red tape and regulations that keep community members from coming inside and sharing classes or programs with the prison population. But it is possible, and it is very, very important. The prison system has a rhetoric about encouraging links to the community. Now, we know that that is not what they want to do, that in fact the opposite is what they want to do. But we can use their own language against them as the rationale for allowing community members to come inside. I think the other thing I would just like to really urge people is to support the political prisoners. We are part of a continuum of resistance that spans decades. And for people to be locked up for 30 years because of their political actions is something that any activist today has got to understand is part of their own life and has relevance in their life, because it is the same struggle now as it was then. And we need to support the comrades and to recognize that there are going to be more political prisoners. Some of us who are activists today on the outside may in fact someday, as a result of our political commitment, be locked up. And we need to build a movement that will be supportive of people, because we need to engage in many different levels of struggle, some of which are not legal. We need to be creative in our approach to resistance and to recognize that we can't let the government define what tactics we use. Otherwise, they'll just control the development of our resistance movement. So I feel very, very strongly that people should educate themselves about the political prisoners and build a movement for their support and their release.
Thank you, Linda Evans. This interview with Linda Evans, political prisoner for over 16 years, was produced by Bear and Betty Miller. Thanks to Rob Seifert for his technical expertise.
The good folks pulled together. It's July 4th forever. Down in celebration, Florida. The neighbors bring you coffee. And everyone's always happy. Down in celebration, Florida. And there's a bake sale. Schoolhouse, and they're selling innocence. They're keeping out the deviants to protect the residents of Celebration, Celebration, Florida. They're buying up nostalgia for a time they can't remember. Lives down in Celebration, Florida. There's a bake sale at the schoolhouse, and they're selling innocence. They're keeping out the deviants to protect the residents of Celebration. There's kids with malnutrition, but not in Celebration, Florida. Social engineering, it gives you that fuzzy feeling down in Celebration, Florida. There's a bake sale at the schoolhouse, and they're selling innocence. They're keeping out the deviants to protect the residents of Celebration, Celebration, Florida.
The fight to stop drilling in the Finger Lakes National Forest is not over yet, and the Finger Lakes Forest Watch Congress is asking forest supporters to take action now by contacting their congressional representatives. The rider in Congress that would ban drilling in the Finger Lakes National Forest has still to go through committee to get into the final version of the bill, something not guaranteed. Supporters are asked to call their members of Congress, and if you've already called them, call again to remind them that we're still here and we expect them to do all they can to make sure that the permanent ban on drilling in the forest passes. The more calls they get, the more likely it is that they will take action. Representatives Maurice Hinchey and Amo Houghton have already committed to supporting the ban. If you can, it would be best to call them in their Washington offices because the fight's not over till it's really over. For more information, you can visit the Finger Lakes Forest Watch Congress at www.flfwc.org. That's flfwc.org. You're tuned to Unwelcome Guests on WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, or WXXE Truxton. Our program continues with an interview with former political prisoner Susan Rosenberg.